The following is an audio podcast from the Korea Society, celebrating over 50 years of promoting greater awareness, understanding, and cooperation between the people of the United States and Korea. For more information on our programs, please visit our website at www.koreasociety.org. This podcast is brought to you through the generous financial support of the Tongyang Group. In the areas of financial services and manufacturing, the companies of the Tongyang Group harness the passion and creativity of 12,000 employees worldwide to better serve their clients. The Tongyang Group, a global partner for Korean business.
On August 4th, 2008, Dr. Charles Armstrong, director of the Center for Korean Research at Columbia University, presented a two-part overview of Korean history at the Korea Society in New York. In this first lecture, Dr. Armstrong provides a general introduction to contemporary Korea, before delving into Korean history, starting with the founding myth of Tangun and progressing up to the late 19th century, when Korea opened up to modern diplomatic relations with Japan and the West.
I teach Korean history at Columbia, as Jay mentioned. My field is really modern history, and the second half of the morning session will be on the modern period, and I will be mainly using images. That'll be the fun part. The first part shouldn't be not fun. I want to basically make some remarks by way of introduction to what we could call traditional Korean history. Now, where does modern Korean history begin and where does traditional Korean history end is a question that many people have asked and for which there's no completely agreed upon answer, but I would say that Korea begins to change considerably in the last decades of the 19th century, particularly as it comes into sustained contact with the West and with Japan. So I will go up till about 11. Actually, I don't want to lecture for a full hour, so I'll stop after a full hour and a half. So I'll stop after about an hour, and we can have a discussion of questions. I know a lot of you have different specific things that you might want to know about Korea. A lot of you, I'm sure, have many Korean-American students. And one of the things I want to talk about in the second half of the morning session is the Korean diaspora, overseas Koreans. My most recent book, which is listed here, is called The Koreas, which deliberately doesn't have a number. I don't talk about two Koreas, but I talk about the different ways in which Korea has been defined and the different ways in which we can look at Korea today. Korea is, as you know, a divided nation between one government in the north and one government in the south. Earlier in the 20th century, Korea was a colony of Japan, and before that, it had a long history of political unity under various dynastic regimes. But in addition, Korea, we could say, consists of people who think of themselves or are considered to be Koreans, and in that sense, Korea extends across a much larger territory than the peninsula here, to communities in the United States, in China, in Japan, in Russia, in Central Asia, and elsewhere. So let's begin with a question. I know you've all read History of Korea, and I've handed out an outline of major dates in Korean history. I'll talk a bit about them. Some are more contested than others. But what is Korea? How do we define Korea? Korea is often talked about as a small country. And one of the first things that I try to convince my students is that Korea is not a small country. It's only small in relation to its most immediate neighbors, particularly China. It's a peninsula now of a population of about 72 million, perhaps 48 or so in the north, 23 in the south, a little over 70 million. Perhaps 6 million people beyond the peninsula who could be considered overseas Koreans or people of Korean ancestry. The largest community of these, as I've said, is first in the United States, which we'll talk about later, about around 2 million, perhaps, followed by China, in which there are about 1.8 million ethnic Koreans. The Korean Peninsula has about two-thirds of the population of Japan. So it isn't that small, even compared to Japan. And in terms of a relative population to, say, Europe, the combined population, again, of the Korean Peninsula is greater than that of Britain or France, and almost as big as Germany, none of which we consider small countries. And in terms of Korea's economic position in the world today, it has perhaps the 12th or 13th largest national economy, South Korea itself. And it is the seventh largest trading partner of the United States. North Korea, of course, has a much smaller economy. The South Korean economy now is considered perhaps to be 50 times as big as the North Korean economy. We'll talk in the second session about North Korea and the difference between North Korea and South Korea and how that came to be. The president of Korea Society, Evans Revere, will talk later this week about the two Koreas, so I don't want to get into that too much. But Korea, even if you consider South Korea alone, is a fairly significant country in the world. Of course, it's not on the level of China in terms of population, but it has, for example, a larger economy than Russia, and it has per capita income ranking in the top 20 or so countries of the world. North Korea, by the way, was also something of an economic success story in the early years, in the 1950s, and then it, for reasons we'll talk about later, went into a big decline. So that's the significance of Korea today. Not a small country, rather a medium-sized country in the world, and one of great importance to the United States. It's the site of one of the largest presences of the U.S. military. There are about 34,000 American troops in South Korea. And it is a country in which we see reports on the news, about which we see reports on the news fairly frequently. Most recently in the New York Times, there was an article a couple of days ago, maybe just yesterday, about allegations of civilians being killed by American troops in the early days of the Korean War. And, of course, we often see reports about the North Korean nuclear issue. And so even relative to the absolute size of Korea, its presence in the world and its importance to the U.S. is quite significant. But Korea doesn't only matter today. It has always mattered in the history of the region around Korea, what we now call East Asia. Of course, East Asians didn't think of themselves as being in the East until modern times, until they encountered the Europeans in the West. East Asians, like all people, thought of themselves as being in the center of the world. But for Korea, and we'll talk about this in a little bit, Korea, for many centuries, considered the real center of civilization to be China. But Korea was very close to China, immediately to the east, and one of the names that Korea had for itself was the Eastern Kingdom, Dongguk. And Korea, however, should not be thought of a place as a kind of transit post or a transmission belt for civilization from China to Japan, which is sometimes what you see in history textbooks. I think that's very misleading. It's as if you had said the only cultural significance of France was to be a transmission belt between Roman civilization and Britain. It's clearly the French would be quite upset if you said that. In the same way, Korea had its own distinct civilization and culture for many centuries. Much of Japanese art, Buddhism, crafts such as pottery came from Korea. Some of it was Chinese culture that came through Korea to Japan, but much of it was actually developed in Korea and came to Japan in the last several centuries. And Korea also had a long history of autonomy, independence, of being a distinct culture and political unit, kingdom. And indeed, we can say that for a period of well over 1,000 years, Korea was a distinct nation or had a distinct identity, except for a brief period in the overall historical scheme of things, from about 1895 or 1905 to 1945, when it was dominated by Japan. And that history, although still leaving a bitter legacy in some ways, and you may be seeing in the news also reports about clashes or arguments between Japan and South Korea over some almost uninhabitable rocks in the sea between them, which is itself partly a legacy of history. So Korea has a long history of independence, of its own distinct culture, of its own distinct language and sense of identity. Korea is an important country in East Asia and now in the world. And without the knowledge of that history, the history of Korea, our knowledge of China and Japan, at the least, would be very incomplete. But how to define Korea? What do we mean when we talk about Korea? First, you can define Korea geographically. As you can see by the map here, it has fairly well-defined boundaries, at least on three sides. It is a peninsula. By the way, this is the island of dispute, Tokto, or what the Japanese call Takeshima. Clearly on this map, since it is the Korea Society, Tokto is part of Korea. And the East Sea is what Japan and most of the rest of the world calls the Sea of Japan, but Koreans have some difficulty with that name. So the Korean Peninsula is one way to define Korea, and in that sense, of course, it's existed for many thousands of years. There has been some dispute at various times over the boundary to the north, which is fairly well defined by the rivers, beginning from here, the Tumen River that feeds into the East Sea from Mount Paektu on the Sino-Korean border, and then to the west, in Chinese, the Yalu, or Amnok River in Korean, which goes into the Yellow Sea. There have been times when Korea was defined differently. Particularly, the northern extent of Korea has gone below the rivers at times, and by some definitions at least, well into northeast China or Manchuria. But generally, we consider geographically Korea to be the Korean Peninsula. There is also the definition of Korea as a political unit, a state, a government. And in that sense, Korea has been a single entity for most of the last 1,000 years. It was unified either in the 7th century or the early 10th century, depending on how you define unification of Korea. But it's clearly, of course, divided into two states today. Nevertheless, one thing, if nothing else, that the governments of North and South Korea, and I think most of the people of North and South Korea, will agree upon, is that there is only one Korea. There is no country in the world in which there is such a gap between the political division of the country and the sense that people have that they really should be united. So even though Koreans can agree that there is one Korea, in reality, of course, as we know, there are two states, two governments on the Korean Peninsula. And finally, you can define Korea culturally or ethnically as the Korean people. And this is the case even though the names that Koreans have had for Korea has changed over time. In English and other Western languages, it's pretty easy. Korea is called Korea. The name Korea, by the way, enters European languages through Portuguese, who were the first people from Western Europe to come into contact with Korea through their explorations in Japan. And their word for Korea comes from the Japanese pronunciation of Koryo, Kore, which was a previous dynasty in Korea from the 10th to the 14th century. So our Western European languages, the words in Western European languages for Korea, Korea, Kore, Korea, comes from this Portuguese mispronunciation of Japanese mispronunciation of Korean word for Korea, Koryo. In the South, Korea is called Hanguk, the country of Han. which is an old name for Korea. And in the north, Korea is called Joseon, which is the name of the last dynastic kingdom from 1392 to 1910, but also a name for a much older kingdom on the Korean Peninsula. Going back to the legendary Old Joseon, Go Joseon, which was founded by the mythical king Dangun. And in modern times, the date of the ascension of Dangun was 2333 BC, but that is, I think it's safe to say, entirely mythical. So there are different names that Koreans have for Korea, which becomes a problem when you have North-South dialogue, because North and South Korea actually have different names for their country. But that's usually overcome by simply referring to the North or the South or the Pyongyang and Seoul, but most commonly by this word, this phrase, 우리나라, our country. There are very few places in the world in which I think the people have such a strong sense of, let's call it, we-ness, the sense of who we are. And the Koreans feel that very strongly, the sense of identity. If you talk about our country among Koreans, even Koreans here in the States and elsewhere, they know that you are talking about Korea. Again, then, who are the Koreans? One thing you see, although Koreans today would like to believe and often do that there is an unchanging identity of Koreans as Koreans. In fact, Koreans, like all people, have evolved in their identity over time. Most often today, Koreans define themselves, and they're one of the few countries in the world that define themselves as an ethnic nation, a 민족국가. That is to say, everybody in Korea is ethnically Korean, with a few exceptions, foreigners who live there. There's a small ethnic Chinese community. And increasingly, over the last 10 years, and this is an interesting point that we'll get to toward the end, there's been a large number of mixed marriages in Korea, and particularly of men from the countryside marrying women from elsewhere in Asia, from China, from Vietnam, Philippines, and so forth. So that sense of ethnic homogeneity is beginning to have some challenges from the outside. Nevertheless, there is no country in the world, with the partial exception of Japan, in which there is such a strong sense of ethnic identity and ethnic unity. Demographers who evaluate these things rate Korea as the number one country in terms of ethnic unity, of people belonging to, of ethnic homogeneity, and Japan is number two. Japan has a small indigenous minority called the Ainu, mostly in the north. So Korea and Japan are very similar in this sense of being almost unique in the world of countries in which people feel themselves to be one ethnic group, one ethnic nation. What does this mean? Well, there's a common language. First of all, Koreans speak Korean. I don't know if any of you noticed my tie, if you can see it from the distance. It's a Hangul, or Hunmin Jeongeum, the Korean alphabet, which I think you'll be getting some lessons in during the course of this course. And there is no significant dialectical difference. Koreans from throughout the peninsula can understand each other. So unlike China, for example, in which there are mutually unintelligible dialects, in fact, in some cases, separate languages, Korean is a common language throughout the peninsula. There is a sense of shared ancestry as well, that Koreans come from the same place, belong to, in a sense, the same family, a sense of, in other words, of shared identity. Koreans, in other words, know they are Korean. They feel it in their bones. Demographically, as I said, it's the most homogeneous country in the world. Yet, on the other hand, there have been challenges to this. As I mentioned earlier, there have been more and more mixed marriages. Now, most recently, about 12%, it's estimated, of Koreans are married to non-Koreans. In the countryside, that's nearly 30%, for reasons we'll get to in a bit, why there's such a disproportion in the countryside outside of the big cities. In some villages, over half of the men are married to non-Koreans. And this is a very recent phenomenon, really of the last 10 years, which has to do with the socioeconomic changes within Korea. Very simply, it's easier for women to migrate into the cities because the sons, particularly the eldest sons of the farming families, are expected to stay behind in the family farm. And therefore, women don't want to marry these farming boys. They want to go to the city and lead a better life there. And so the men, or rather their parents generally, but sometimes the men under their own initiative have gone through various agencies to find wives for themselves. So this has interesting implications for the future of this strong sense of ethnic homogeneity, ethnic identity. And we'll get back to that at the end of the morning session when we talk about the Korean diaspora and the challenges to Korean ethnic insularity. So what makes Korea Korean? What makes Koreans Korean? This is something that itself is a product, in a way, of modern times that simply wouldn't have occurred to most people anywhere in the world, including Korea, before, let's say, the 19th century. People didn't move around. People didn't have much contact with foreigners or even people much beyond their immediate village area. So there was a sense of identity to the place where they lived, to their families, to their clan, and not to this rather abstract notion of a country or a nation called Korea, or whatever it might be. There were times in history where Korean identity could have been shaped quite differently, that Korea might have even disappeared altogether, or never come into being. And yet, this sense of identity, this strong sense of Koreans being Korean, is still very present. If you go to Korea, if you even have much dealings with Koreans, even here, you'll feel that very immediately. So the historical question is, where does this come from? Not what is the history of this unchanging thing called Korea, which we can trace back to ancient times, but rather, how did Korea over time, or how did the people of the Korean Peninsula over time develop this distinct sense of themselves as a people? We can go back to the myths of origin. Like many people of long history, Koreans have myths of where they came from. And there are several different ones. I think your textbook talks about a number. The most common story today is the story of Tangun, who, I don't want to get into the legend of Tangun, but who is son of the sky god and a bear who became a woman, which is a very interesting story that can be interpreted in many different ways, having to do and having its origins, it seems, in the totemic or religions, the naturalistic religions of Northeast Asia, to which Koreans are, of course, related, to which some of their ancestry derives. But you'll find over time, and really in the 20th century only, did Tangun became the established myth of the origin of the Korean people, and you'll still hear about that in Korea today. In fact, in earlier times, Tangun was not seen as such an important figure, and the emphasis, at least at the level of the court, of the government, was on a character named Kija, K-I-J-A, who came from China and established another kingdom called Joseon somewhat later. The first, in fact, complete version of the Tangun story that exists today only was written down in the 13th century by a monk named Iryon in a book called the Samguk Yusa, or the Miscellany of the Three Kingdoms. And it's been interpreted in new ways in modern times. So there are various ways of interpreting this story. It can be seen as a kind of reflection of the very old indigenous religion of the people of Northeast Asia. One legend, for example, associated with Tangun, or one version of the Tangun myth, has him born here, Paektu Mountain, which is the tallest mountain, a volcanic crater with a lake in the middle on the border between China and Korea. And interestingly, another ethnic group in Northeast Asia, the Manchu people, you might have heard of. The Manchus also have a myth that their people originated there, and this very impressive, almost eerie volcanic, extinct volcano there on the border between China and what is now North Korea. It could be seen as a kind of a story that was told over time to create this sense of Korean identity, particularly when you look at when this was first written down, or at least in the form we have it today, which was a time of Mongol domination of Korea. The Mongols coming from Mongolia, obviously, North China, and having dominated Korea. The most remarkable recent story about Tangun is that about 15 years ago, North Korean archaeologists announced that they discovered the bones of Tangun as it happened near the city of Pyongyang, which happens to be the North Korean capital. And through extraordinarily precise dating, discovered that his bones were exactly 5,011 years old at that time, and built a monument to Tangun, which was under the orders of Kim Jong-il, who was not the leader at the time, but the son of the then leader, Kim Il-sung. And so in this sense, Tangun becomes this ancestor of the leadership of North Korea itself. Well, these are myths. What do we know from what we could call the science of history or of archaeology? Probably there were people on the Korean Peninsula at least 40,000 years ago, maybe even well before then, arriving through several waves of migration from the north of Asia and also from China. And over thousands of years settled on the Korean Peninsula and went through the typical successive evolution of human settlement from Stone Age to agriculture. Elements of religious practices, I mentioned Tangun, which seems to be related to the worship of animals, bears and tigers, and spirits of nature that still exist in Korean shamanism or indigenous religion today. Much of the literate culture comes from China until the 15th century Korean language was written in Chinese characters, as was Japanese and Vietnamese as well. Clothing styles, which are still considered traditional clothing in Korea, also come from the continents, very much influenced by Mongolia during the period of Mongol domination. In the social structure of Korea, they settled into clans, we call them in English, and clans in turn organized into larger units called tribes, so from families to clans to tribes. And Koreans still talk about belonging to these kind of extended ancestral units, which we can call clans. You may have noticed, if you know many Koreans, that there are relatively few family names. Kim, Park and Lee, or Kim, Lee, and Park are the most common names, comprising about two-thirds of all the people of Korea. About two-thirds of all Koreans have one of those three surnames. And then there are a number of others, but pretty much, as they say in Korea, if you throw a stone into the air, it's most likely to land on the head of a Kim, a Lee, or a Park. These names themselves come from China, or they're Chinese character names. And many Koreans until the 19th century didn't have, in fact, family names. But these family names themselves are divided into clan units. Every Kim, Lee, or Park, Che, whatever, is able to trace his or her ancestry back. I would say his because this Korea was a patrilineal system, right, that you traced your ancestry through the father's line exclusively. Traced his ancestry back to a place of origin, that the very first Kim of your family line, my mother, for example, is a Kim, and her family line goes back to Kimhae in the southeast. So they are the Kimhae. Her father's family is the Kimhae Kim family, the Kimhae clan of the Kim family. And that, again, seems to have its origins in the tribal system of Northeast Asia. And the religion of ancient Korea, like that of many people of Northeast Asia and then even of North America, is animistic. All the natural things have spirits, rivers, animals, trees, and so on. And there were special people who could communicate with those spirits, which anthropologists in modern times call shamans, who communicate with the spirits of nature and of the dead and so on. And we still see traces of that and, in fact, practices of shamanistic religion still occur. There are still shamans, mostly women, interestingly, mudang, in Korea today. If you want to, even though Koreans may be Christian or Buddhist, if you have something special you want blessed, starting a new business, sending your child to a good university, Koreans may call on a shaman to perform a ritual to do that. The emergence of the state or to organize these tribes into something more institutional begins, it seems, around the ninth to fourth centuries BC, increasingly influenced by the culture of the continent, that is to say, of China. As I mentioned earlier, Koreans have traditionally tended to look to China as the source of civilization, much the way that Western Europeans look to Greece and Rome as a source of Western civilization. But that doesn't mean that Korea was part of China, that Korea from very far back, the people on the Korean Peninsula, let's say, have this sense of themselves as being not the same as the people in the various Chinese kingdoms, which itself was not unified. There has not been this thing called China forever. There have been various dynasties, various kingdoms on the continent of Eastern Asia, which have had a lesser or greater degree of control over the territory that we now call China. But the first written record we have goes back to about the 2nd century BC, and we have encounters of the Chinese with people on the Korean Peninsula. This character Kija, that supposedly founded a kingdom called Joseon, also appears in Korean records and in Chinese records. The most significant and early encounter was with the Han Dynasty of China, which unified what we now call China for the second time in the 2nd century BC and conquered the sort of northwestern part of the peninsula there, around Pyongyang, and established military colonies or commanderies on the peninsula, four of them altogether. The most important was Lilang or Nangnang near what is now Pyongyang, but there were several others in the northeast and even farther south. But it seems that these military commanderies were rather enclosed entities, something like the current Green Zone in Baghdad, if you can imagine the Chinese as being like the Americans today in Iraq. But there was a great deal of encounter between the cultures of the Chinese occupiers and the indigenous people of the Korean Peninsula, and this seems to be really the beginning of a large scale importation of culture, language, and political ideas and institutions from China into Korea. Again, if you think of a European analogy, Korea at that time, at almost exactly the same time in history, in fact, was rather like what Britain was to the Roman Empire, that the relationship between Han China and the Korean Peninsula was something like the relationship between Britain to the Roman Empire of exactly the same time. Even though Britain wasn't Roman exactly, wasn't Italian, let's say, it still was part of the Roman Empire and very much influenced by Roman civilization, in the same way the Korean Peninsula was by Chinese civilization. Eventually, these Chinese commanderies were dissolved in about the 4th century, and you had a series of what we've come to call Sinicized or Chinese-influenced kingdoms on the Korean Peninsula. In the south, there were three kingdoms called Han. The second character was called Han, Mahan, Chinhan, Pyohan, which is the origin of the word Hanguk, which we still have for Korea, or at least what people in South Korea call Korea. And these consolidated again into three kingdoms, Goguryeo in the north, which extended a little bit south of Pyongyang into Manchuria, Baekje in the southwest, and Shilla in the southeast. Now, if you're reading closely the New York Times, you may see occasionally reports of some dispute between the current governments of China and Korea about this kingdom of Goguryeo. And the Chinese argue that Goguryeo was always part of China, and Koreans will argue that Goguryeo is really Korean. To me, as an outsider, it's a little bit of a strange dispute because I don't think we can really define something as Korea or Chinese at this time. But anyway, it does show how, although our history in this country is relatively short, and for some parts of the world, quite ancient history can lead to quite heated arguments. Now, we talk about kingdoms. So what do we mean by a kingdom? Well, first of all, kingdom is something that's governed by a king, obviously, which is a term, wang, that the Koreans adopted from China. That has some kind of division of labor. There's high and the low, the monarchy, the royal family at the top, an elite, a group of priests, farmers, workmen, artisans, and so forth, and eventually slaves. As in most pre-modern societies, there was slavery in Korea, which seems to have been hereditary, and indeed some argue by the late Joseon period, a very high proportion of the Korean population was slaves. They were not foreign slaves or slaves from a different ethnic group. They were Koreans, but nevertheless, they had a very low social status. There were fairly high developed political institutions as well as systems of education derived mostly from China by the 4th century or so AD, around which the time first Goguryeo from the north adopted Buddhism. Buddhism, as I'm sure you know, comes originally from what is now India and then was taken mostly through Tibet into China and then from China into Korea, or Goguryeo, first, and then the rest of the peninsula as well. In addition to Buddhism, so we have now a second kind of religious layer. Right? We first talked about shamanism, the more indigenous, animistic religion of people of Northeast Asia. And then, as it were, on top of that, or intermingled with that, is Buddhism, which became the predominant religion for much of Korean history. And then the third religious or philosophical religious element was what we call Confucianism, or the teachings of the sage Confucius from China. But beyond that, Confucianism was a mix of teachings of different masters and also forms of government, of familial relationships, in general, of social relationships, and also cosmology and many other aspects of philosophy and thought, which we can or we cannot, depending on how we define it, consider a religion. But certainly, it was Confucianism became an extremely important belief system in Korea, not only for people's daily lives, especially among the educated elite, but also the way that people, boys and men predominantly, were formally educated and people were trained for government service in the Confucian tradition in China and Korea and in Vietnam. Japan is a little bit different. Entering government service was considered the highest achievement for a man, and therefore Confucianism as a means of educating and testing people to enter the government bureaucracy was extremely important and was cared for and supported by the government. Koguryo, the northern kingdom, was at the beginning the most advanced, the most influenced by China, and the most warlike. Interestingly, if you go to North Korea, the North Koreans tend to think of themselves more in the tradition of Koguryo, and Koguryo is very much emphasized in North Korean history, periodically clashed with kingdoms on the continent in what is now China. But eventually, the southeastern kingdom of Silla is the one that came out on top in the conflicts among these three kingdoms. It was the most recent, established only in the 4th century. Based in the southeast, and it's not here on the map, but is around here, the city of Gyeongju. How many of you have been to Korea, by the way? Okay. Not only two of you. All right, well, you'll have to go there. Is Korea Society going to support their visit to Korea? Okay, well, you should apply for a Korea Society trip. But if you go to Korea, you'll definitely go to Gyeongju, which was the capital of the Silla Kingdom. And there's still tombs of the kings there and many relics of this ancient kingdom. And in particular, there are some spectacular Buddhist sites, temples and statues from the Buddhist period, because Buddhism, which was adopted as a state religion in the 6th century in Korea, was very important for all three kingdoms. Silla, of course, is emphasized in South Korea partly because it's in the south. You can't go to the Koguryo ruins in the north. But also because for a long time the presidents of South Korea were from this region of Korea, and I think that has something to do with why these historical relics were so well preserved and emphasized. Silla defeated Baekje to the southwest, and the Koguryo kingdom in the north in the 660s. And in 667, 668, unified most of the Korean peninsula, not all of it, up to about this line here, a little bit north of Pyongyang, and created what we call unified Silla. Although there was another kingdom called Pare to the north, but there's some dispute of whether that's really Korean, whatever that means. There were people from the old Koguryo kingdom who were in the ruling class, but also indigenous people from northeast China, living there as well. But in any case, many people would talk about Silla as being the kingdom that first unified Korea. It established many of the cultural practices which we still identify as Korean. It had a very close relationship with China, although initially there was a conflict with Tang China. But nevertheless, Silla adopted many cultural forms from China. This was a really peak period of Chinese culture, the Tang Dynasty. And if you go to Chinatowns in North America, I don't know if that's the case in New York, but in San Francisco and Vancouver, the Chinatowns are called Tangjie, or the Street of the Tang, because Tang is considered a really efflorescent period of Chinese civilization. And this is the point at which, to a great extent, Chinese culture deeply influenced Korea and Japan. Silla sent students to study in China, and monks went to China as well. Silla was also a great trading nation. It did a lot of what we call international trade, exporting silk, cloth, gold, silver, and manufactured goods to surrounding countries. And indeed, Silla was the first Korean kingdom to be even known in the West through Arab merchants who knew the country as Asilla. The Arabs had an extensive trading network in Southeast Asia and the China coast, and encountered Koreans there in their trade. Korean ships under Silla sailed as far as the Indian Ocean, and was part of what we might call an international system consisting of Tang China, of Pari to the north, and Japan. So it was a very dynamic period of Korean history. Within Silla, it was becoming what we might call a more China-like society, a centralized bureaucracy ruled by the king, a hereditary aristocracy underneath that. Commoners, that is mostly farmers, were the vast majority of society. Like in all pre-industrial societies, most of the people work somehow in the process of making food for people to eat, not necessarily hoeing the ground themselves, but somehow involved in agricultural work. And at the bottom of the society were the low-born people, people considered at the lowest end of social interaction, almost a kind of untouchable class. Not exactly as in India, but a hereditary segment of society that bears some similarity to the caste system of India and South Asia. These included slaves, as I mentioned before, and also until relatively modern times, the outcast or the lowest class of Korean society included all sorts of people who were involved in work that was not either government-sponsored or considered productive. That meant musicians, artists, entertainers, actors, and so forth. By the 8th century, the capital of Silla was one of the most dynamic cultural centers in the world, and certainly in East Asia, with hundreds of thousands of residents, with a thriving urban culture, lots of leisure, the time to write books, which you still have today, a visual and artistic culture of a substantial elite. And here, again, we see the pattern of what we might call traditional Korea that existed until the 19th century. There was this mixture of religious and philosophical systems, of which the most important was Buddhism, which was sponsored by the Silla government, had a great influence in art and architecture, which are still important historical treasures in contemporary Korea. And over time, the predominant form of Buddhism, if you're interested in this, was what the Chinese called Chan, or the Korean Sun, and the Japanese Zen, which is a meditative practice of Buddhism. And that's the dominant form of Buddhism throughout East Asia, China, Japan, and Korea, particularly Korea and Japan, what we call Zen Buddhism, which is a rather austere rather, as it were, individualized Buddhism, which emphasizes cultivation and meditation. And Korean monks traveled through China and as far as India. But Confucianism, which was also coexisted with Buddhism, was very important. It was very much involved in scholarship. Young men and boys learned the Chinese classics. And again, as I mentioned before, the literate culture, the culture of writing, was what we call classical Chinese, which is not to say that Koreans were reading a foreign language as they saw it, but rather that the language of writing, of scholarship, was Chinese, pronounced in a Korean way, which was very, very different from the Korean language. As you may know, the Korean language is utterly different from Chinese. It is a completely different language family, close to Japanese, but as different from Chinese as English is from Korean. But the vocabulary of Korea became more and more adopted from Chinese to the point where now about 60% of Korean words have Chinese origin, much in the way that a great deal of English has origins in Latin and Greek. And the scholarship of Korea was written in classical Chinese, much in the same way that the scholarship, the high culture of Europe until modern times, was Latin. And there's actually a very, very close parallel in that respect. And in addition to Buddhism and Confucianism, the folk religion, animism, shamanism, worship of spirits, communicating with the dead, was also a very important and inseparable element of Korean culture. I think one generalization you can say about East Asia as a whole, and Korea specifically, is that in contrast to European civilization, there was a relatively harmonious coexistence of different belief systems. Whereas in Europe, there were wars and conflicts of all kinds over religion between Christianity and other religions, native religions, between different forms of Christianity, between Christianity and Islam, between Protestantism and Catholicism. You didn't see much of that in East Asia. There were plenty of wars. People always find good excuses for killing each other, but they tended not to kill each other over religion. Rather, religions or systems of belief, in fact, even the word religion doesn't really apply in the same strict way to East Asian belief systems as they have in the Abrahamic, the Muslim, Christian, Jewish tradition. They tended to coexist and sort of mixed with each other in fairly harmonious ways. Shila was a great period of cultural dynamism and economic dynamism in Korea. And the great early 20th century Indian poet, Rabindranath Tagore, you may have heard of him, Tagore, T-A-G-O-R-E, wrote a very famous poem called The Light of Asia. He writes, "In the golden age of Asia, Korea was one of its lamp bearers, and that lamp is waiting to be lighted once again for the illumination of the East." He's referring to the Silla period, but he's writing at the time of the Japanese colonization of Korea. So a time in which the light of Korea, as it were, is being hidden under Japanese occupation, which seems to be what he means by the fact that, by the statement that the lamp is waiting to be lighted once again. Silla, however, did not endure indefinitely, by the early 9th century, by the late 9th century, early 10th century, the Silla kingdom was beginning to break apart. And there were new usurpers to the throne arising in different parts of Korea. At the turn of the 10th century, that is the 900s, a new three kingdoms emerged. A later Baekje in the south, later Koguryo in the north. But it was the northern kingdom this time which dominated, defeating Baekje in 934 and Silla in 935. This later Koguryo shortened its name to Koryo, which you see on the historical handout. And in 918, in our calendar, of course, the Koreans didn't use the Western Christian calendar, but we do. In 918 A.D., the king of surname Wanggeon, established himself as the king of Koryo over all of the Korean peninsula. And this is the point where Korea really comes to define the boundaries, going basically all the way up to the Yalu and Tuman rivers. The capital of Koryo was here. This is, of course, the DMZ that divides North and South Korea today, in the city of Kaesong. Koryo was a kingdom which saw itself in the tradition of Koguryo, the northern kingdom that preceded it. And if you look at histories from North Korea, they would say that really it's under Koryo that Korea becomes really unified, and that what we think of as traditional Korean history really is established. But Koryo continued on many of the traditions of Silla, of a king on top of a hereditary elite, but with a great deal of meritocracy. That is to say, people entered into the upper ranks of the elite through examination. And this is at a time when in Europe, the Roman Empire had collapsed and the European continent was divided into very warlike feudal kingdoms. We could say that Korea was, in some sense, much more settled, even much more civilized, and this notion of a state examination really didn't get established in the West until much later, but was already deeply entrenched in Korea by the 10th century. Buddhism was very much promoted by the new state, and monks became very important figures in some cases, and monasteries became quite powerful. And this was also, in some sense, a mirror, or had some similarity to what was going on with Christianity in Europe at this time, in which under the feudal system there were many important Christian monasteries and important Christian monks. The Koryo kingdom existed for almost 500 years. And one of the interesting and unique things about Korea is how these dynasties last for a very long time, much longer than in China. The branch of Buddhism also, again, was Sun or Zen, which was well established under Koryo. And the king himself encouraged people to engage in meritorious acts through Buddhism, and was popularized throughout the society. But one of the things that emerges in this time very strongly is a kind of conflict between the continent, the north, and the Korean peninsula. And in a sense, the biggest event of this was finally when a nomadic group of people in the far north of Asia were unified under a fellow you may have heard of, Genghis Khan, whose grandson conquered China and established the Yuan dynasty of Mongol rule in China. And in the 13th century, established domination over Korea. They invaded Korea. And that's when the Koreans began, the king and his court retreated to Kangwa Island off the west coast of Korea. One of the great achievements of Korean culture that still exists today was the careful handwriting out of the Buddhist Tripitaka, or the three baskets of Buddhism, which you'll see in Korea in the south today. But also, it was at this time that the legend of Tanglin that I began with is fully written out for the first time in a form that exists with us today. The Mongols didn't incorporate Korea into their kingdom exactly, but they made the court of Korea pay tribute to the Mongol emperor and required princes of Korea to marry Mongol princesses, to intermarry the royal families of the two. And there was also a strong cultural influence. In the latter 13th century, the Mongol dynasty, the Mongol kingdom, which was the largest land kingdom ever in the history of the world, going all the way from the Korean peninsula to Western Europe, decided that they would next try to take over Japan. And Korea was used as a kind of launching pad for a naval invasion of Japan in 1274 and again in 1281. But the fleets of the Mongol emperor didn't make it to Japan. Much of it was destroyed in a typhoon in 1281. And in Japanese lore, out of the 20th century, this typhoon which destroyed the Mongol invasion was called the Divine Wind, or the Kamikaze, which you may be familiar with from World War II. Toward the end of the Mongol dynasty, of the Koryo dynasty, eventually the Mongols were defeated in China and they left. But Koryo continued. A new form of Confucianism emerged, which we now call Neo-Confucianism, and a new group of literati, or scholarly rulers, also came to power. And with this new Neo-Confucianism came a new stress on civilian leadership, a kind of dismissal or downplaying of the military as leaders of society, and of an emphasis on intellectual merit and of education. And in a sense, this sort of Neo-Confucian emphasis on education is still something that we see in Korean culture today. We might ask, why there is so much emphasis in Korean society on formal education. I think part of it has to do with this very strong Confucian strain of emphasizing education as the only really means to moving up in society, that the best way to become an important person and to consequently bring benefits to yourself and to your family was through formal education, through reading books, through going to the right kinds of scholarly institutions. And this begins to really take hold in the end of the Goryeo dynasty. And Buddhism is in a period of decline, and there is a kind of reaction of parts of the elite against the power of the Buddhist church, we might call it that. And a general by the name of Yi Sung-ge, surname Yi, or Li, leads a revolt against the Goryeo rulership and establishes himself as the king. And he calls his country Joseon. The name Joseon is a reflection of a very old name for Korea, but also it's sometimes called in your older textbook as the Yi dynasty or the Li dynasty as the name of the ruling family. We've been going on for an hour, so I want to take a bit of a break and take questions here. We probably take our full break at 11 and then talk a bit about Joseon. Any questions so far? We've covered a lot of ground. We're covering a good 1,000 years of Korean history in an hour, so it might be new to a lot of you. So do you have any questions or comments? Yes.
Okay, you mentioned education and meritocracy. How much social upward mobility was there?
Yeah. Well, that's an interesting question. How much social mobility was there? Especially in the Joseon period, the elite was limited to a hereditary group, pretty much. Theoretically, it was a meritocracy, as it was in China. But there seems to have been more social mobility in China. In Korea, pretty much you had to be born into the elite in order to take the examination to enter the government service. So there was meritocracy within the elite, but it was very, very difficult to enter that elite from the commoner class. And if you were a farmer, you couldn't just go to the state examination and test to be a government officer. You had to already have that family ancestry. Now, the actual rule was that you had to be able to trace back 5 generations of people who passed the exam. But the reality was it had to do with your family background. It was, however, possible not only to enter the elite from the commoner class occasionally, but also to fall out of the elite after many successive generations, of not passing the exam. So that was another reason to make sure you had one child, one son in the family who could pass the exam. Because if you didn't, over time, you could end up falling out of the elite into the commoner class. So this created a kind of anxiety within the elite about making sure that at least, you know, one person was able to study. So there, that, in a sense, is the origin. It eventually became, as it were, filtered down throughout the society. But it I think this is one of the origins of the aspect of Korean culture which emphasizes making sure the child is educated, because you had to have an educated child in order to maintain your social status. And so you would pick out the brightest son to study from a very early age, 4 or 5 years old, in the Confucian classics to eventually make it into the elite. So Korea, especially the Joseon period from the 14th century, was basically a very stratified society with the with a hereditary elite on top, maybe 10-15%, a very large group in the middle, 70% or so of agricultural workers, and then a kind of inversion of the elite, an outcast or a low-born group on the bottom, which consisted of slaves, of entertainers, and also of people who were associated with or dealt with professions that were considered lowly. And these often had to do with Buddhist proscriptions against handling dead things. So executioners, butchers, tanners, those sorts of people were considered very lowly. And Japan had something very similar, if you know something about Japanese traditional society. And those people had their own villages, those low-class professions, their own surnames, and really you didn't mix with those people until the 20th century. That stigma is largely gone, but it was very, very strong up until the 20th century against the low-born people. Any other questions? Yes?
You mentioned slavery.
Yeah. Well, when it began is a difficult question to answer, but, you know, almost all tribal groups and states had slavery of some kind. Often they were the people who were captured in war, and that seems to be the case very early in Korean history. But it's a little unclear where slavery later came from, other than the people who were born to slave parents. But when it ended is very clear. There were two kinds of slavery in the Joseon period, officially. There was a so-called public slavery and private slavery. The public slaves were working for the government. The private slaves were owned by households, by private households. Public slavery ended in 1805 by the government, and private slavery was abolished in 1894. But there are stories of you know, slaves living with their master's family well into the 20th century. Any other question? Yes. Well, Confucianism didn't have much of a problem with dealing with slavery because it was a social philosophy which argued that there were social distinctions, high and low, that should be maintained. And also, in fact, Confucianism is a very hierarchical kind of thought system. There is no equality. Men are superior to women, old are superior to younger. One could take that logic further to say that slaves naturally belong in their place. Buddhism had the potential to be more egalitarian, and there were some Buddhists which argued not so much against slavery. You didn't really see much of that. There were some intellectuals that argued against slavery, but that was pretty rare. But Buddhism could be interpreted as a belief system which allowed any individual to attain enlightenment. But very few Koreans really thought of it that way until modern times. Interestingly enough, it was really with the introduction of Christianity in the late 18th and 19th century that a religion entered into Korea that more people took as a basis for arguing against the social hierarchy. And I'll talk about that next, about the introduction of Christianity to Korea. But Buddhism and Confucianism really didn't seem to have much of a problem with this social hierarchy, social distinction. Okay, let me talk a bit about the Joseon period for the next 15 minutes, and then we'll take a well-deserved 15-minute break. And then the next half will be on the modern period. Joseon Korea, as we tend to call it now, or the Yi Dynasty, the Joseon Dynasty, was the longest lived of the Korean dynasties. And what do we mean by dynasty, by the way? What is a dynasty? It was a really bad TV show when I was a kid in the 80s. But what is a dynasty, before we go on? Yes? Yes?
I would think it's a kingdom. Yeah.
Right, it's exactly, yes.
Successive ruling family.
Right, it's a kingdom that is ruled by a family that passes on from one generation to the next. That was a model adopted from China which the Koreans used from basically the Silla period onward. And so the Joseon dynasty, or the Joseon kingdom, was ruled by the Yi royal family up until its demise, or its founder, Yi Songge. And this period of time is what we often consider traditional Korea. It was the longest-lived dynasty in Korean history, indeed one of the longest-lived dynasties in the history of the world, going on for 518 years. Japan had a royal family that supposedly traced its ancestry back 2,000 years, but it didn't actually rule the country for most of that time. But the Korean kings were really running the country. The Joseon period is usually divided into early and late, and the dividing line is generally considered to be the invasion of Korea by Japan at the end of the 16th century, 1592 to 1598. The early period of Joseon is considered to be a much more dynamic period of Korean history, the second half after the invasions, which were really very traumatic. Was a period at the beginning of great economic turmoil, and then people consider it often a kind of a more decadent period, a period of stagnation. I think that's partly to do with the way the dynasty ended, but it is certainly true that the Japanese invasions were tremendously destructive. The Japanese forces came into Korea under the warlord Hideyoshi, intending to go through Korea to conquer China, didn't make it to China, but in the meantime wreaked a great deal of havoc and destruction on the Korean peninsula. Joseon overall had a few characteristics which we've now already seen and are familiar with, but really became very, very much entrenched in this period. It was a kingdom modeled on a Chinese polity, the Chinese political system of centralized rule, with a capital built on a rectangular grid, with the imperial palace in the north looking south over its people, which you still see that layout today in Seoul. A pyramidal system, a pyramid-shaped system with the king at the very top, his family underneath, and an elite beneath that, of scholar officials chosen by examination. But in fact, as I mentioned before, drawing its members from a hereditary elite of families. And indeed, by the late Joseon period, the number of families who had sons in the elite was relatively small. So it had become a very enclosed, very small kind of elite. And all the others were commoners with no voice in the government. The government revenue was drawn from the countryside, mostly in terms of a tax in kind and in goods. And it had a kind of regressive tax system. That is to say, the farther down you were in the social order, the less you gave to the government. In its international relations, shall we say, in its way that Korea dealt with the world, really, especially after the Japanese invasions, Joseon had very little contact with any part of the world except for China and Japan. But it dealt with China very differently than it dealt with Japan. China was considered an elder brother of Korea in the Confucian scheme of things, a place of significant cultural achievement, and indeed the origin of much of the high culture of Korea, whereas Japan was seen a bit more distantly as a neighbor or a more or less equal kingdom within a whole system of world civilization, as Koreans saw it, which was centered on China. The center of the universe, as far as the elite culture of Korea went, was China, and the Chinese emperor ruled the world with the Korean king as a subordinate to the emperor. In reality, although this was the theory of it, in reality, Korea was more or less left to do what it wanted, as long as it gave symbolic deference to the Chinese emperor. So periodically, three or four times a year, the Korean court would send a mission to the Chinese court in Beijing and offer luxury goods and horses and silks and so forth in exchange for goods from China, and congratulate the emperor on his birthday and on the new year and so forth. And in turn, China would offer its benevolence to Korea. Whereas Japan, Korea had relatively little contact with. There was a trading post around Busan of Japanese merchants who were essentially confined to that trading post. They couldn't go into the interior of Korea. And there were some trading missions through the island of Tsushima, which is not on the map, between Korea and Japan, and a few diplomatic missions from Korea to the capital, Edo, which is now Tokyo. But the important issue was that Korea, for its formal contacts with China and Japan, was largely left to itself. In a way, Joseon was the most isolated of the successive kingdoms on the Korean peninsula. It had adopted the classical Chinese language, the political system, much of the elite culture from China. Although Korea had invented an indigenous writing system, which we now call Hangul, a phonetic writing system, not an alphabet exactly, but a much more phonetic system than Japan, which had a syllabary, a system of syllable writing. But Korea invented a very distinct, almost scientific, as it were, writing system based on pronunciation, although it mixed it with Chinese characters. And the Hangul, or Korean phonetic writing system, was usually considered somewhat low compared to classical Chinese. Classical Chinese was the language of the scholar elite. Hangul was more of a practical writing system for people who didn't have as much education, farmers, women, people like that. Although there was literature over time increasingly in Hangul as well. The Japanese invasions of the 1590s disrupted a relatively stable system. And although Korea reestablished relations with Japan in 1609, didn't have any more to do with Japan than it absolutely had to. And furthermore, not long after that, in 1627 and again in 1636, there was a new group of nomadic people in the northeast. Whoops, what's happening here? I think I'm losing my battery. In this region, which we now call Manchuria, because that name that we use for it is derived from the indigenous people of that region called the Manchu people. They began to coalesce together, much as the Mongols had did several centuries earlier, into a very strong tribal group, which eventually decided that they were going to take over China. But before they did that, the Manchus demanded that the Korean king recognize the Manchus as the government of China, which they refused to do since they were quite loyal to the Chinese who had helped prevent Japan from taking over Korea earlier in the Japanese invasion. So the Manchus invaded Korea in 1627, and again 9 years later, until the Korean king was forced to recognize the Manchus as the rulers of the Middle Kingdom, or China. And in 1644, the Manchus invaded China. So, as Korea was just recovering from these horrific Japanese invasions, they were invaded again by the Manchus. And this certainly reinforced a notion in Korea that maybe foreigners should be kept out, that foreigners were trouble. And this certainly deepened this sense of isolation and desire to be isolated that the Koreans had. So a few formal diplomatic missions a year to China, more irregular missions to Japan, and basically no contact with the rest of the world. This characterized the Joseon Kingdom. Oh, okay. Yeah, thanks. Oh, actually, I don't need it anymore. That'll do. And However, there was some indirect contact with the West, and that was through the Korean diplomatic missions to Beijing, to China. There was some, and in Beijing, there were an interesting group of Europeans from Italy and other European countries who were propagating Catholic Christianity. They were the Jesuits. And through the Jesuit missionaries in Beijing, Koreans first encountered Christianity in the late 18th century. And so Catholicism began to enter Korea at that time and spread surprisingly quickly among the educated elite, for reasons which we're still not entirely clear about why Christianity took hold the way it did. But other than that, essentially Korea had very little contact with the outside world at this time. However, something was going on which would make it very difficult for Korea to ignore the West, and that was the increasing encroachment of the West on China itself through a series of wars between Britain and China in 1839 and 1842, the Opium Wars, in desire on the part of the Europeans and the Americans to become involved in the trade with China, and in a period of European domination of the world through colonialism, of the diffusion of Western military and economic power throughout the world, to which East Asia was almost the last place that the West had been more or less kept at bay. But of even greater significance for Korea ultimately was what was happening in Japan. Japan, seeing the threat of the West in the mid-19th century, took a very different path from China, which essentially tried to keep to its old ways, and that was to undergo a dramatic, indeed an extraordinary self-imposed transformation. This did not come about easily. There was a lot of conflict within Japan about this, but in 1868, a group of samurai of the warrior class took it upon themselves to overthrow the existing military government of Japan and reestablish the young emperor who took on the reign of Meiji to the throne in Tokyo, and embark on a process of modernization of Japan. This eventually made Japan the only Asian country, the only country really outside of Europe and America, to have modern systems of military organization, of constitutional monarchy, of economic development and industrialization, and of education. What did the Koreans think of all this? They were aware of what was going on in Japan, and they didn't like what they saw. The Korean elite thought that the Japanese were becoming barbarians. Of course, like most people, Koreans thought of themselves as being civilized, and those who were not like them in culture to be uncivilized. And all of these things that were happening in Japan were considered by the Korean elite to be very disturbing. In 1869, a year after the Meiji Restoration, Japan sent an envoy to Korea informing the Koreans of this change and that the Japanese king was now Emperor Meiji. The Koreans were quite offended because in their scheme of things, there was only one emperor, and that was the Emperor of China. And all the subordinate kingdoms around China were ruled not by emperors but by kings. As a result, they refused to accept the envoy from Japan. Japan considered this to be an insult and contemplated attacking Korea in the early 1870s, but decided against that. And instead decided to actually do what the Europeans were doing, which was to try to press upon Korea modern types of diplomatic relations and economic and trading relations. But the Koreans also didn't want that. They were a tough nut to crack. The Europeans and the Americans also had no luck opening up Korea at the time. And in the 1870s and 1880s, Korea earned this nickname, the Hermit Kingdom, as being this very isolated place which didn't want to have anything to do with the outside world. And finally, in 1875, Japan did to Korea exactly what the American Commodore Matthew Perry did to Japan, which is to send gunboats to the ports of Korea, to the main port in Kangwa Island, and to demand that Korea establish formal diplomatic and trading relations with Japan. It was an offer the Koreans couldn't refuse, of course, and so Japan, ironically, became the first country to have a modern system of diplomatic and economic relations with Korea. Then the other Western countries followed. And in a sense, we can say this is, although the Koreans might not have been aware of it at the time, this is the end of what we would call traditional Korea and the beginning of modern Korea, which will be where we take up from after the break. Thanks.
The opinions expressed in the preceding program are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Korea Society, its staff, management, or sponsors.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Korea Society. If you enjoyed it, please consider becoming a member. Visit www.koreasociety.org for more information about memberships and to learn more about the programs available at the Korea Society.